Hello.
Hello.
I was halfway through the hello before I realized, like, oh, this is where I try to do something different every time, so I should say hello differently, and it just kind of came out weird.
Were there normal hellos that we've done in the past?
I mean, you know, they're all a slightly elongated variation of normal, but I mean, that's just kind of our thing now. I say hello in a weird way, and then you parrot it back to me, usually in a mocking way. But I didn't come up with any good this time.
Yes, I do parrot it back to you in a mocking way. But you didn't come up with anything good this time.
That's not the same. It's not the same bit. It's different.
It's a different bit.
It's a weirder bit.
It's a weirder bit. So
how's it going?
I'm okay. How are you doing?
All right. It's a weird day, so I guess it's fitting that we picked a weird movie, although you picked the movie before the day, so it's just it's weird on like eight different axes. Are there eight axes, or are there just a couple axes?
Well, you know what they say, you can pick your movies and you can pick your days, but you can't pick your anyway. So
axes?
Yeah. I told you this was a weird movie.
I must have missed the part where you're like, hey, this is weird. I just remember the part where you're like, hey, this is a fun movie that I really enjoyed watching on wherever you rented it a month or two or whenever it came out ago.
It was like 3.5-4 months ago, something like that. Probably four.
You and like one other person on Twitter was like, oh, this is really fun.
Well,
and I was like, yeah, interesting.
No, also Micah. I made Micah watch it.
Sure.
Yeah, we talked about it on Unhelpful Suggestions, and you listened to it and you commented about that, but you know, I think you just forgot that I told you it's a weird movie. It's not Bridesmaids. It is much more like Austin Powers, although I said Austin Powers meets like 22 Jump Street or something, and you had said Austin Powers meets Step Brothers, which you know, may be more accurate, I guess. I just don't like Step Brothers, but
I don't like Step Brothers either.
Yeah, but I like this movie. It is incredibly weird, and it's so stupid in the way that I really appreciate. When I first watched it, the hardest I think I probably had laughed in a long time up to that point was when they do the whole bit about asking what his room is, and he says 611, and Annie Mumolo does the whole like thing, like as if they're like next door or something. She's like, oh, 611 Star, did you hear that? 611. And then just like freaking out, and then it turns out they're in 124, but they're still super excited about it.
Yeah, that was good. There's a lot of dialogue in this that I don't think it was necessarily improvised in the way that a lot of the, you know, the Step Brothers type movies can be improvised, but I think they wrote some of this stuff out, and they just shot all these really elongated, weird conversations. Like, the Trish conversation on the airplane is insane. It's just absolutely insane. There's, what, three or four different cuts over the course of a four-hour flight, and they're describing all of the amazing traits that are Trish, and then they're still talking about Trish when they get off the... Wow.
Yeah,
it's
culminating in the death of Trish. The very legendary death of Trish. Which
she's not gonna let cancer beat her. She's gonna off herself. Is that basically what it was?
Apparently, she's going to take her own life by jumping off of the rocks, and then be in charge of her own destiny and become a water spirit. And this whole thing that you think is a throwaway joke, and then there is the end of the movie. Also, if you haven't watched the movie, just watch the movie. It's on Hulu now. It's not even like a special rental thing. Although, go ahead and rent it too. But go ahead and watch it, then come back to this, because I seriously don't want to spoil the jokes by just describing them, because it's not as entertaining to you. But the fact that they revisit Trish by having the water spirit be the Deus Ex Machina solution to their problem at the end of the movie, and it turns out it's Reba McEntire and two turtle puppets, I think is just
fantastic.
Yeah,
they come up to the shore, and both me and Amanda had the same thought, but she said it out loud, like, what was that? And then, of course, Mr. 50 Shades of Man says, what was that? And they explain it was Trish. That one of many jokes that appears to be a throwaway that is not a throwaway for some reason.
It's funny how it, like even on what was it? They bring up Tommy Bahama. Wendy McGlevin Covey when she's trying to convince them to go. She says, you know, men dressed head to toe in Tommy Bahama, and she's so excited about that. I love it. Sells it really earnestly. But then later on in the movie, Andy Garcia comes out of some bushes, and it turns out he's Tommy Bahama, which is very funny to me because it's. Like I said, it's really stupid. So
he's the spirit of the island or town or whatever. It's not an island. It's
a city
in Florida, apparently, but not really.
No, it's Cancun. Is that where they shot this? Yeah, they shot it in Cancun. Cancun for Florida, but
better go to Florida.
Yeah, I guess it's one of those things where there's all these unexpected, like, jokes in this movie that are so stupid and such, like, little throwaway things. But then they'll revisit it and harvest it for some other dumb thing to twist and do. Like, the antidote that he has, turns out that it's the lemon-flavored iced tea that she makes her suicide with at the beginning of the movie.
I would love to know the thought process behind the introduction of the bad guy known, according to IMDb, as Sharon Gordon Fisherman.
Yes. What introduction do you need to Sharon Gordon Fisherman?
she comes out and says, would anyone like a drink? I'm going to make a suicide. And she has her own bespoke evil lair soda fountain. And mixes herself a beverage, which is, I think supposed to be intimidating or some sort of dramatic moment there. But
Yeah, it's not supposed to be intimidating. It's supposed to riff off of the James Bond, or, you know, in Austin Powers they do this too. Riff off of that thing of the bad guy has a lair. It has like a model of something that can transform or move or whatever, a la Goldfinger, and. It turns out that it's a soda fountain, and she just uses it to make what was when we were, you know, children, referred to as a suicide, where you put together all the different flavors from the soda fountain. I believe that is no longer politically correct. There are several things in this movie that are no longer politically correct.
Is there a new term for the beverage?
No, I don't know. But I just know that there's just a. You probably shouldn't just go around saying stuff like you used to.
No, I mean, that's sort of across the board.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm not trying to cancel Barb and Star. Far from it. But, you know, it's just one of those things where they're referring to something juvenile from when we were children, where you would do this with a soda fountain. And, like, I remember when I was a kid and you'd go to Burger King, where they had the soda fountain where you could fill it up yourself. McDonald's didn't do that. That's how they set themselves apart at the time, which is such a silly thing to think about now.
I think I remember a McDonald's that had a self-serve soda fountain.
It came later in Tampa, at least. But anyway, the Burger King, you could do the thing. And, you know, it was all about, like, what would you mix in your soda? So to do something like this, where it's obviously something very childish, but it's very dramatic at the same time, is entertaining, and it really throws you off of what I think anybody's expectations for the movie are, because the trailer for this movie did not make me want to watch the movie at all. It is a montage of the sort of like dancing on while sitting on the sofa thing that they do in Jennifer Convertibles later, and I was like, I don't understand what this is. And the poster for the movie is very Lisa Frank, which is charming, but again, have no idea what's going on. So then you watch the beginning of this movie and you're like, what is happening? Because it is so Austin Powers, where there is a villain with a ridiculous plan and an evil lair.
Doesn't it technically open on the villain?
Yes. It opens on Yo-Yo, who is the child that the villain had abducted and brought into her employ, and
As you do.
Yeah, as just anybody does. And Yo-Yo is distributing newspapers on his paper route and then arrives at a tree, is scanned by an owl. The tree opens up.
I can't believe I already forgot the sing-along paper route and then the very dramatic throwing of the final paper and then riding his bike to a field and entering a tree with a mechanical sort of security door.
Yeah. My favorite part is the elevator has a button and it says lair. And that is the only button. So you can't really go anywhere else, which is strange because you'd think when you were in the lair, you'd want a button that said surface. But he pushes the button.
Maybe it's an OLED. Maybe it changes when you get to the bottom.
It's a very sophisticated e-paper over the backlit button.
Yeah, that would be very battery efficient.
Yeah. So it goes, or maybe they just have a henchman who changes out the button every single time it goes up and down.
See, now that's very evil lair. You have somebody there who's designated to throw one giant, like, mechanical switch on the wall to change it from lair to surface.
Yeah. See, that's the kind of thing that an evil villain has in their employ. So we go down to the lair. Lair is very Dr. Evil. And we have Jamie Dornan standing there, Yo-Yo, and the Dr. Guy, who is dressed as Dr. Guy. And that's all you really need to know about him.
He's Dr. Scientist.
Yeah, and then...
his character's known as Elderly Scientist.
That's kind of rude.
He's not even elderly. He's in his 50s.
Yeah, he's not elderly. That's rude.
Jeez. But, he's 60 years old.
Then Kristen Wiig comes in, dramatic music, makes the suicide, sipping on it loudly.
Kristen Wiig, a version of Kristen Wiig that takes a moment to recognize, decked in white clothing from head to toe, and... I guess she's some sort of fictionalized version of albino who is paper white and has white eyes and jet black hair.
Yeah. Again, like I was saying, not trying to cancel the movie, not the most woke thing to have this sort of like ableist thing about the villain and that's why they're evil and stuff, but...
Yeah, but they didn't even do, what's the, is it, Me, Myself, and Irene, where you've got the albino kid who, pretends that he murdered his parents because they moved to Arizona and he couldn't stand the sun or whatever, like, mm-hmm. she says this thing where, like, she has, like, no pigment or whatever and she stays out of the sun, but, like, we don't see her being harmed by the sun.
No, and it's a very fictional, thing, but,
Some sort of Latin pigment deficiency phrase.
Yeah. And then they go over to look at the project. That's her life's work, which is a cow in a room. And there are these mosquitoes that can kill with one sting. And they're all ready to go. You just have this transmitter and they're attracted to the transmitter, etc. And then the doctor realizes that they're not trying to... put down animals with rabies, and he is put into the thing. He says, "Yo, you can't do this because my house is riddled with evidence." And Yo-Yo pushes the button that blows up the newspaper that he put on the porch. And Jamie Dornan is dispatched on a mission to deliver the microchip to Vista Del Mar. We go to the opening credits, then to Jennifer Convertibles, where Barb and Star are not really doing anything other than talking about nonsense, which is their sole character trait, is they're sort of empty-headed, and they have just nothing but nonsense to say to one another, but they both act like everything that each other says is the most interesting thing that they could think of. Mm-hmm. And
they're very earnest in their silliness, but they're also not... Mm-hmm. Like Dumb and Dumber level stupid characters, and I feel like they grow over the course of the movie to be less vapid, but maybe that's just because their souls become so fulfilled.
Yes, well, they do have that arc, but they never have the moment where they're like rocket scientists by the end of the movie. But they are.
They're very smart for this universe that they live in, where there are Reba McEntire water creatures and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, they have just an intuition that they don't really know about when it comes to things, I guess.
Yeah, like writing off the cuff. What did she say? Greeting cards or
Yeah.
some form of poetry? It's, anyway, yeah. In this very unusual world, they are extremely normal people. So there's that. But yeah, you've got this very weird opening scene with the evil lady with killer mosquitoes and a computerized microchip thingy that doesn't make any sense, but doesn't matter because none of it makes sense. That you think is really setting you up for a lot of stuff, and sort of like, you know, the thread of putting the locator in the middle of Seafood Jam, which is the yearly event in Vista Del Mar, so she can destroy everyone there. That's there through their whole movie, but really it's a story about love and
Yeah, well, I mean, it's
I
a
don't
good
know,
way to
betrayal,
it's a
finding yourself
yeah
also.
it's a friendship. Friendship is important. I think that is
Friendship is
probably the key element of this.
I think the key element here is really just honesty, you know, being open and
yeah.
honest about your feelings and your goals and your friends. And you know, if you think that they're going to be upset by your growth because you're growing away from them, turns out that's not true because you're best friends no matter what, through thick and thin. I feel like I'm about to do a song, and there's lots of songs in this movie too,
Yes. And
for
I
basically no reason.
no, but they're why do you need a reason? It's
I mean, it's
fun.
not like it's a musical. There's just like they burst into song, what, like three times?
Yeah, but I love it when they burst into a song. It wasn't a moment where I felt like it was inappropriate, because the movie is so silly that I don't care. Like, it's not a musical, so you know, it would it's not the kind of thing where you'd want them to do this in Clueless or something, which is also a comedy, but like it would be weird there because that's not the tone of it. But this movie is so silly, that it doesn't matter if they burst into song. In fact, it is fine within the confines of this universe,
Yeah.
especially when the song contains lyrics about murder and stuff. So I don't know what Barb and Star would have heard when they entered the hotel. When they cut to Jamie Dornan singing his part about having to murder everybody, but they do that. You have Jamie Dornan's wonderful song, Edgar's Prayer, which I think is hilarious. You have Richard Cheese, who is the like bar lounge piano player singer, and he provides his own level of
Is
stupidity and charm.
his name is Richard Cheese.
Richard Cheese.
His name is Dick Cheese. I can't.
I mean, yeah, Dan, we all got it.
Did we though? But all right. Anyway, yeah. So, like the first, honestly, the first like 20 minutes of this movie is so silly. I was on the verge of getting silly blindness or something that I get with some of these like Step Brothers-y type movies where I just completely lose interest because there's nothing for me to like grab onto at any given point. Like there's so much silliness, you don't know if they're ever going to be able to like recover from that dangerous edge, but they do, and they turn it into an actual story that you can pay attention to and be interested in and care about in a weird way. But yeah, to be honest, like the first 20 minutes, aside from the fact that they talk so fast and kind of high, and it's just like, yeah, I feel like I missed 80% of the words. I get the vibe, but then like thankfully it turned into a little bit more of a real movie because it was a little rough in the beginning there for me.
I felt like the beginning was a little unexpected for me. It does throw you a bit of a curveball from
It's
the opening
fun though.
scene.
Like Talk Club seems like an SNL skit that was disused
Cut
and
for time.
brought into this one just so they could have some just delightful cutaways of people who, you know, could really use their own trip to Vista Del Mar.
Yeah, I mean, we get Wendy McLennan Covey after they're laid off from Jennifer Convertibles because it had actually closed 7 months beforehand as a national chain and nobody told them. After they get laid off from that job and they run into Wendy as this character Mickey, who doesn't matter, she's not in the rest of the movie. But she, you know, is rant she's raving about how she went to Vista Del Mar and it was so great and all the things that were great about it, blah, 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 blah. She says she's going to leave them a brochure when they go back home later. They are self-conscious about the fact that they don't have a job now. They go to Talking Club.
They seem to have a lot of money for people with no jobs, though.
Yeah, well, they got severance, which they didn't want. They wanted to give back the severance so they can continue working at Jennifer Convertibles, which is very, again, very funny to me. But in Talking Club...
They didn't
club,
even get to take their couch with them, did they?
No. Well, it wasn't their couch. It was just the couch they sat on at work, which they didn't want to sell to anybody.
Well, you know, floor model discount. Take it with you.
Well, they didn't want to give a floor model discount.
Make that make that be your severance.
Yeah. I mean, you'd think they're going to have like a store liquidation or something.
I mean, but I would have stolen the couch if they had closed and laid me off in that fashion.
I feel like stealing a couch is a lot. But
it's not a lot. It's more than a little, but it's not a lot.
I mean, it's couch, Dan. It's not. Yeah. It's not. You know, post-it notes.
And an insolvent furniture company is going to come after you for a couch?
Well, I mean, somebody buys their assets to liquidate them. So whoever bought Jennifer Convertible's assets would come after them.
Look at Mr. Capitalism over here.
Yeah, yeah.
Why don't you care about Barb and Star's couch?
I do care about Barb and Star's couch. Barb and Star don't care about their couch after they get axed from this job.
I feel like we should have had a post-credit scene with the couch instead of the post-credit scenes that we did get.
I like the post-credit scenes we got. I don't feel like the couch was that important. Mm. But they, in Talking Club, they are hosting it, apparently.
Don't say in Talking Club like that makes total sense.
It doesn't make any sense. It is basically a club where Debbie, played by Vanessa Bayer, is this bully who has somehow manipulated all of these people into following her very strict rules. And it is about the selection of topics with which to discuss, and nothing else can be discussed, and everyone needs to arrive at Talking Club on time or they're locked out. And she's very strict about it. It is not clear what anyone gets out of Talking Club other than Debbie's approval or disapproval, and Debbie just seems to get off on tormenting everyone with her rules.
Well, I know you live in Los Angeles, and it's been quite some time since you lived in the suburbs, but Talking Club is, you know, it's very important. It's the way you establish the social hierarchy out here in the suburbs.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's kind of riffing off of, you know, book club or whatever, and all the silly rules that people can come up with to police the other people.
Bible study? Did you ever do Bible study?
No.
Me neither.
God. But I liked you know, the whole thing with the hot dog soup and
God, it was so ugly.
When Phyllis Smith as Dolores tries to talk about her horse and you know gets chastised for it, she has to give up her soup. And
hot dog soup.
When they lie about having lost their jobs, they're kicked out forever from the Talking Club. So
'cause the first rule of Talking Club. You don't talk about Talking Club.
You don't lie in Talking Club, apparently.
That's rule number three is no lying.
Yeah. But
God, Vanessa Bayer's from Cleveland, Ohio.
I'm sorry.
Yikes. Sorry, Vanessa Bayer.
I mean, she seems to be doing okay for herself now. I don't think she's currently in Cleveland, Ohio.
You never know.
Yeah. But she...
Oh, man, she's only 3 years older than me.
Yeah, just think about how much more successful she is.
I don't want to, but thank you. I appreciate it.
But
she's only a year and a month older than you.
Yeah, that's, you know, I think about how people my age and younger are more successful than me all the time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But back to the movie. They've lost everything now because they don't have Jennifer Convertibles and they don't have Talking Club. Those are the only two things that they had anchoring them. And
they also live together in a lovely apartment.
It was sort of a house thing, or at least a condo villa. I don't know what the deal is, but they...
Where did they live in this movie before going to Vista Del Mar?
I think it was Soft Rock, Nebraska was the name of it.
Oh, that's right. There was a title on that. Yeah. Okay.
But they, you know, Kristen Wiig as Star goes on this whole thing about how they need to, you know, really shake things up and this is their chance to go live their lives right now because they don't have any constraints. And so they should go to Vista Del Mar. And Barb thinks that they'll probably die or be dragged out to sea or someone will kill them, etc.
She's very afraid of ocean currents.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand. I can empathize with Barb in that situation. And, you know, her husband...
They're both divorcees.
No, her husband died. Ron Quicksilver died.
Sorry, apologies. Ron Quicksilver died.
He had a heart attack. And Kristen Wiig's husband left her for... Dina, I think, was the name of the character we never see, but it seems to have destroyed her self-esteem, and she thinks that she's disgusting, and no one would ever want her. But they're going to go get, you know, everything back on track by going on this vacation. And they finally agree to do it. They hop on the only remaining set of MD-11 that I know of, I guess. I'm not sure where they got that, but they take that to... Vista Del Mar, bore everyone on the plane, get off, talk about Trish dying, and then they show up at the hotel. There's a huge musical number about how great the hotel is, and then they say they're so... they join in on the last verse of the line, which is supposed to be the Palm Vista Hotel, and they say the Palm Vista Motel, and they are cut off, stopped from continuing the conversation because what's-his-face? Michael Hitchcock as Gary... he says, oh no, you guys aren't here. You're across like two football fields in a burning hot parking lot over at the other thing.
Across the parking lot, which is two football fields long, basically, which is just incredibly Florida. So yeah. That's good.
And so they go to the motel. They check in. There's some clever set design with a shark mauling somebody in a painting when they come in the door. The guy asks if they would like towels. And if they want sheets, and there are no pillows, which they just begrudgingly agree to. And
it very much reminded me of the hotel I stayed at in Little Armenia out there in LA.
I mean, you should just like use Trivago or something, Dan. I don't know what to tell you. You need to do some more research.
It wasn't a lack of research that landed me at that hotel. It was a lack of reasonable availability.
Okay.
You know, Los Angeles is kind of expensive.
It is kind of expensive, yeah. Yeah. But they go to the pool, and by the pool, I mean they sit on the rim of the empty pool and watch a guy who's in the deep end of the pool playing cards on a folding card table with himself.
Was the man blind playing cards on a fold-out card table in the deep end of the empty pool?
I don't know. I just know that he was playing cards by himself. And then they, Barb comes up with the plan. I'm sorry, Star comes up with the plan that they will sneak into the pool at the nice hotel. And Barb is upset. She's like, "Is that even legal?" And Star says, "I don't know." And so they're feeling
they're starting to live on the wild side and be bad girls.
Yeah, and so they go back to the Palm Vista Hotel, and they have the wonderful experience of sneaking in with their big sun hats and sunglasses to try and blend in with everybody else. They get the food menus, and they're talking about, you know, whether they're going to get veal stuffed manatee or frog legs.
You feel bad with the frog's legs because all you think about is Kermit riding his bike and how much he used his legs to do that. I love the flashback at the end there.
Yeah.
Or when their lives are flashing before their eyes, there's a clip of Kermit riding a bicycle.
Which is
very cute, by the way, but absurd.
Yeah, well, I mean, the movie's absurd. But then Michael Hitchcock shows up and he, you know, they're going to get kicked out of the pool, but he says that a room has opened up if they want it. The family that was supposed to be there hasn't shown up and they're missing. And he thinks that it's always the husband. The husband probably killed them, but you can have the room if you want. And they agree.
Very excited. Yeah. It's wonderful how quickly, and this is again where they were kind of sort of maybe going to lose me, is that they set up the terrible hotel for future antics, but they just immediately throw that joke away.
Well, I didn't need more jokes about how bad the hotel was.
You don't need that joke at all because it's been done. But you think that's where they're going, and they're like, "Oh yeah, don't worry about that. You get to stay at the fancy hotel now."
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I don't think it's illegal to go use the pool at a hotel you're not staying at.
It's technically trespassing.
But like at a place like this, like the resort is open to people who want to come like use it for the day. If you like buy food and stuff.
It depends. When we were at the Sheraton Waikiki, they had controlled entry, and you had to use the little RFID bracelet thing they gave you at check-in to scan it to see whether or not your thing was valid, that you were still there. And then they would give you one of those like concert wristbands, you know, the like wax papery kind that, you know, sticks to itself, and so you'd have that on too. And that's how they would determine who was actually allowed at the pool.
So were there like velvet ropes and stanchions for like a VIP section of the pool?
No, but there were the cabana things, which were already rented out. And so you had the first come, first serve, like regular loungers.
Oh, sure. A cabana is always going to be extra/reserved.
Yeah. And so, you know, it was like a feeding frenzy trying to get the loungers there. But
you know, that's a good reference. I got that one.
Mm-hmm. Was it?
Feeding Frenzy is the name of a Jimmy Buffett album.
Oh, yeah.
But you knew that. You did that on purpose.
I did that on purpose. But they... so anyway, it doesn't matter. Like, they weren't going to be thrown in jail or anything. But they have the room now. They're excited. They, you know, get new sheets every day, sort of. And they are going to go, you know, have their cocktails and stuff. When they go to have cocktails, they, of course, are seated at the bar next to Jamie Dornan, who is bummed out because the only thing he wants more than anything in the world, the only reason why he's even doing this, is for Sharon Gordon Fisherman to be official with him, to be an official couple. That's all he wants, is to be in an official couple, which is charming in its silliness and absurdity. But he's really bummed out, and he's just having whiskey. And Barb and Star work their magic on, you know, their sort of naivete and goofiness cheers him up a little. They go in on what was it? The shipwreck blue something thing?
Something had a skull and crossbones next to it. I forget what it was
called. Yeah, I forget the name of the drink. But they have it. It comes in an enormous fishbowl. It's blue, which, as we all know, as adults, blue is the color of danger when it comes to drinks. Don't have a blue drink.
Yeah. You know, fishbowl should be a warning sign as well, especially the larger ones. But
yeah, especially when someone has made a pirate ship out of papaya and put it on top of your fishbowl of blue liquid.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, there's buried treasure in the bottom of it. And they're like, oh, I didn't find any buried treasure. And he's like, you didn't find the extra liquor at the bottom and then the pills? And then they're like, oh, yeah, we drank that. We took the pills. And he's like, oh, well, there's your treasure. You're going to have fun. It's like, what? A giant fishbowl drink that has additional alcohol and pills at the bottom of it? Great. That's the kind of drink that'll put you out.
Yeah. Well, they have an amazing night after that. I like the shot where he says that in sort of like slow motion, and then their like section of the bar is, they have the camera attached to that, and it sort of wheels away from the rest of the bar. They're all just sitting together still with the fishbowl like thing in front of them.
It's a three-person bar-mounted Snorri cam, but yeah, it's very weird. Even Amanda's like, what are they doing there? They're just like spinning around and attached to the thing. Like, yeah. Yeah, that's what they're doing. They're driving around a bar with a table attached
it
to them.
I mean, it worked. They're, you know, disoriented. I mean, it's better than having the same, like, stupid kaleidoscope swirly thing that everybody does when everybody's, you know, drunk or on drugs.
No, it was a very neon-colored sort of Hunter S. Thompson thing going on there.
Mm-hmm.
Fear and Loathing in Vista Del Mar.
They get to go, you know, party now out on the dance floor. And then, of course, one thing leads to another, and they have threesome.
Yeah, they wake up in a mostly naked stacked sandwich on a bed. Mm-hmm. I guess in their room, right?
Yeah. Which, you know, is nice. Because I especially like the little pink pillow that is on Annie Mumola's butt. Somehow,
of course,
like as the cherry on top of the sundae. but they, you know, separate. Jamie Dornan thanks them for the extremely weird night and leaves. And Barb and Star have the reaction that only Barb and Star could have, because they're not, you know, like we said, they're not like real people. So they're just like, oh, he was a nice man.
Yeah. And it's funny too, because they briefly do the whole, like, they don't remember what happened, and there's like a quick flashback. But you expect them to be sort of like an additional plot point about like trying to put together what happened through the night. And it's like, no, not really. They all understand implicitly what happened, and they're good with it.
Mm-hmm.
Except for the fact that Edgar lost the microchip that he hid in his belt buckle for some reason. And again, I kept waiting for him to go back to the room and like search around on the floor trying to find it. And he's like, no, that's not what's going to happen in this movie. There's going to be a new character added who can provide a new microchip to replace the one that was lost. And then we get to meet Damon Wayans Jr. So he's here.
Yeah.
And he's being Darlie Bungle. Mm-hmm. Which I love him in this movie. I don't know what the hell he's doing, but I love him.
No, I mean, his character serves no real purpose other than injecting more absurdity into it. Like, it's just another situation where the jokes are really just dumb. Like, he's very bad at his job is the joke. And mm-hmm.
I like the wrestling on the beach, though. That was very good.
Yeah. But I like, you know, the introduction where he says it's an untraceable number and blah, 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 blah. And he says, oh, well, it showed your number when you called me. And he said, oh, no. Well, at least it didn't show. Did it show my name? Darlie Bungle. And he says, no, is that your name? And then he's like, oh, shoot. And then he starts telling him how to spell it and stuff, and he can't help himself.
His age, his address, all of the pertinent information.
It's very funny to me that he's just so bad at it. Ultimately, he has very little like purpose to any of this, but he serves a very minor role. But he delivers.
He's the rival spy. Comedy. He's like he's the competition for Jamie, Edgar, whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like when they wrote it, they're like, we need this rival character because that's just the trope, but he's not going to do anything. He's just there.
Yeah, well, I mean, they also needed somebody to, like, take the photos and, you know, do the other stuff. So, you know, whatever. But Jamie Dornan is having some doubts about this process. He keeps having these phone calls with Sharon Gordon Fisherman about...
By the way, did they ever actually say Sharon Gordon Fisherman in the movie?
Yeah, when she's doing her backstory, I think, is when they say it.
Oh, okay. Because I did not realize that was the name.
Yeah. And they keep having these phone calls, awkward phone calls, where she doesn't know how to lead him on in a good way, which is funny, too, because she's supposed to be this big, you know, fearful boss, but she can't even manipulate his simple emotions of going official in a very effective manner. But he has left an impression on Barb and Star, and they do some fun stuff during the day, but then they decide to retire back to the room and pretend like they weren't even thinking about Edgar. And Annie Mumolo goes to go take a shower, take a bath, and Kristen Wiig goes to write something. Annie Mumolo is secretly going out the door to out the window, to go hang out with Edgar, and she hangs out with him and realizes that, you know, she can't betray her friend, that would be wrong, and she thanks Edgar and then goes off.
She doesn't love him. She loves herself, and she's excited to explore and become herself.
Yeah, which is, you know, a valid thing to say.
And conversely, Kristen Wiig realized she does love Edgar, and they have the exact same date, eating ice cream and riding the paddle boat under the bridge and walking on the beach. But, you know, they come to different conclusions at the end. I don't know how Edgar ate that much ice cream, although I guess he wasn't really eating it the second time. He was just kind of holding it.
Yeah. But, you know, he may have worked up.
Somebody's got to stay in shape.
Yeah, he may have worked up an appetite, though, after they had sex twice on the beach.
Sure, on the hard wooden stairs of the lifeguard tower or whatever.
Very funny. But Kristen Wiig goes back, and Annie Mumolo has caught her, seemingly. But she hasn't really.
They're all too trusting, so the truth isn't going to come out until they really say the truth or mm-hmm. somebody else says the truth.
Yeah, so they lie about having seen turtles. Kristen Wiig went to the turtle's house.
She walked the turtle home to the turtle's house near the bushes.
And
turtles.
Then when she asked Annie Mumolo, Annie Mumolo can't think of a better lie than she saw a turtle in the tub. And later on in the movie, when they have to lie again, a turtle comes up once more. So it's nice that they can't think of any other lies to use than the turtle.
You ever seen a sea turtle? They're pretty great.
Yeah, I like sea turtles.
You ever touched a sea turtle?
No, you're not supposed to. It's illegal.
Is it really?
It's supposedly.
I know you're not supposed to like startle them or like freak them out or whatever.
Yeah, but you're not supposed to interact with them.
Huh. Mm-hmm. Like in any fashion, you're not supposed to like catch their eye or whatever.
Well, at least in the state of Hawaii, they have signs very explicitly telling you, do not touch them. It is a federal offense, which leads me to believe.
How close can you get to a turtle before you're like, can you take like a selfie with the turtle, or is that an offense?
It seems impossible more than it is an offense, but you can go for it. I mean, you can take pictures of turtles as much as you want to. When I was at the Sheraton Waikiki, I had my 350mm lens, and I took a photo of a sea turtle that was coming up for air on the water from the 28th floor.
Now that seems extremely legal, but also a little creepy. I'm talking about like, can I take my iPhone and selfie cam and get right in there?
I it's just the turtle outside living his life. I'm not like spying on him with his children or anything.
You're being a little paparazzi-ish.
But it's a sea turtle.
For all that turtle knows, you rented a room on the 20 whatever earth floor just so you could stake out him and his family.
Yeah, it was just him. He's just bobbing up for air, and then go back down, eat some algae, come back up.
Well, you know, he doesn't know what you're there for and why you're taking photos of him with a very long lens.
You're right. I didn't get it.
You're causing him as much emotional distress as maybe a pat on the shell would.
Yeah, I didn't get a release from him, a signed release, so I'm going to have to destroy the photos.
Well, yeah, it's public space. It's not really how that works.
So, anyway, they do a little back and forth of, like, deceiving one another about what they're doing. Barb innocently wants to, you know, actually go on adventures now that she's left up to her own devices, and feels ashamed that she's not including her friend who is sick, who has the flu, maybe might feel better in a couple hours, and is very self-conscious about it. So she's not having as much fun as she should have because she feels guilty.
But then she goes on to have all of the fun. Mm-hmm. She does so many weird things. Does she ride like a horse or something? No, she's riding a motorcycle or a scooter or something.
And she
goes. She's in a very weird drum circle thing.
She goes over a canyon with her little.
Oh yes, that was the funniest thing.
Yeah,
that caused all of the laughs out loud, was jumping over some sort of grand-ish canyon on a scooter.
Yeah. You know, Florida's famous for. And you can see in all the aerial photography.
For being very high up in the air and having lots of different canyons.
Yeah, but they do that whole thing. That's how she meets Tommy Bahama, and he gives her the wisdom that it's within herself and that she needs to, you know, love herself first or whatever. And she freaks out because of Tommy Bahama.
We become a good friend by becoming a good friend to ourselves, mm-hmm. or something like that.
Yeah, that I believe that's literally what he says.
And then stitched on the inside of every Tommy Bahama shirt, by the way, if you didn't know. That's the motto, the company motto.
Oh, man, is there anything that company can't do? But then...
I can't believe they are... Well, you would know this. There's a Tommy Bahama store in the middle hangout area of the Tampa airport.
Oh. Well, that's fine. Do you want to hear something that I'm sort of ashamed of a little bit?
Do you own some Tommy Bahama clothing?
No. I ate at Tommy Bahama when I was in Hawaii.
They have a restaurant?
They have a restaurant.
Huh.
They have several restaurants, actually. One time when we went to the Big Island after we landed, Jason really wanted to go to the Tommy Bahama, and we had coconut shrimp there and a Mai Tai.
What kind of cuisine is served at the Tommy Bahama?
I think you'll find that it is mainly fish and burgers and fries and coconut shrimp and stuff.
It's like a Red Lobster.
No, they try to fancy it up a little, or, you know, whatever. Yeah. But I mean, it's still, it's not a Michelin star activity.
I feel like it's like a, like it predates sort of like a Guy Fieri thing, in a sense that it was like the, can't believe these words are coming out of my mouth. I feel like it was like the slightly classier version of the Jimmy Buffett set. So mm-hmm. I think like you're probably like a 5 or 10 years out from Tommy Bahama being like unironically appreciated again for being like the slightly classy kind of, you know, suntanned flip-flopped person thing.
Yeah, the classy version of Margaritaville.
Exactly. That's it's true, but like I think at some point like the pendulum is going to swing back to people like unironically appreciating it again at some point.
Perhaps.
Given the staying power that Margaritaville has had, by the way, just as an aside, nobody listening to this is going to understand. One of those videos that I shot in Tampa was for an AV company, and they do restaurant like TV stereo installation type stuff and lighting. And one of their largest customers is Margaritaville. And he went on and on and on about all of the different hotels and restaurants they were opening worldwide, all around the world, and all of the AV stuff that they were doing for these incredible Margaritaville restaurants and hotels.
Well, good for them, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Margaritaville is like Florida's Ritz-Carlton, I think. So it's like it's like royalty there.
Mm. I wouldn't put it quite like that. Regardless. So we left off, sorry,
I have to interrupt and go back to my story for just a moment, because this is something you will greatly appreciate and understand. Remember our discussion about Celebration?
Oh yeah.
The Disney thing. Mm. Apparently they're going to do that, but with Margaritaville.
So, oh wait. No.
Like a senior living community based around Margaritaville. Yeah. No. It's a thing.
No.
So when you move back to Florida, I know where you should move to. I don't know if it's. I wonder if it's been announced yet. I assume it's just called Margaritaville, but.
Well, you can't call them all Margaritaville, so. Differentiate it somehow. The residences at Margaritaville?
It's called Latitude Margaritaville, your new home in paradise, and it's in Daytona.
Oh, God. God.
Look at this. Oh, you can apply here, location of interest, age range, move in time.
No, just let them lie down in a shallow grave right now.
Florida?
Yeah.
Oh, there's several. Daytona Beach, Hilton Head, and Water Sound, whatever that is.
No, thank you.
Hmm.
So, anyway, Star is having lots of sex with Edgar, and he has an important business meeting, and Star excuses him. She says, I understand, you know, you are a clam inspector here on top business. She says it earnestly, because she truthfully believes that that would be something that he would be doing. And they still
Someone's got to inspect the clams, Joe.
Yeah. Well, she gets her clam inspected up on the balcony.
Hey-o.
Then Barb sees this whole thing unfolding from where she was feeling guilty about going out on the banana boat without Star. Then she gets upset and goes up there, but, you know, in classic sitcom fashion, they just miss each other, and she arrives at the door just in time to hear Edgar loudly talking on the phone to Sharon about what is going on with the evil plan to place the transmitter with the mosquitoes and everything, which, again, she takes as complete truth, does not question that being a real thing that would happen at all. Which is also charming, and she doesn't get to listen.
It's lovely though when she goes back to Star is like and reciting the plan in an accusatory tone, and she's like, "That's not a thing. What are you talking about?"
Yeah, but she believes it 100%.
Yeah,
and also it turns out she's not wrong. It just is.
He's gonna kill
silly.
Everyone at. Again, I have to say it. Seafood Jam.
Yes.
Seafood Jam.
Yeah.
That. As a matter of course, after crowning the shrimp queen, fires them into the air with a circus cannon, which has a dial on the side that goes from gentle (toddler) to probable death.
Yes.
I love that the lowest setting is calibrated for toddlers.
Yes.
To shoot a toddler out of a 20-foot circus cannon into the ocean.
Yeah, I mean, it's fun for all ages. I don't know if they have, like, you know, shrimp queens in, like, different age brackets or whatever, and you have, like, shrimp princesses or something.
And maybe, like county-level shrimp princesses?
Yeah, maybe that's why they have a toddler setting, because, you know, just so they...
Oh, sure.
Get them in on the action, I guess, at a young age. But,
yeah,
you know, this is the thing that apparently...
People train their whole lives to be a shrimp queen.
This is apparently the thing that pushed Sharon over the edge when she was a child. She lost her only friend to an alligator or something in the swamps of Vista del Mar. And she went to the seafood jam with her dad, and she got separated from her dad, and the mean kids put her in the cannon, put a fake crown on her and put her in the cannon and fired her.
This emotional, like, carry moment where they push her on stage and put a tiara on her head. But it's not bad until they put her in the cannon and turn it up and fire her into the ocean. But, like,
well, she doesn't land in the ocean. She lands on a Disney cruise pool.
Right, of course. She lands naked in a Disney cruise pool.
Mm-hmm.
Because the velocity of the cannon made her lose her clothes.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
as you do.
That's just what happens when you get fired out of a cannon, to be honest.
Yeah. So they, you know, she hears the whole thing, but she gets found out because she has to very quietly try to tell the other ladies who come across her about where she got her leaf and pearl necklace from Unbelievable. The lady can't hear her, and she keeps raising her voice louder, and then she eventually just yells at her about how it's a play on words. And then Jamie Dornan hears the whole thing. She drops the glass, runs away. She goes back to Star, and they have a confrontation about how they've been lying to each other and how Jamie Dornan's really, you know, secretly after them, blah, 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 going to kill everybody. And Jamie Dornan on the phone is told to go kill them by Sharon, who, you know, wants them to be terminated. Which is also weird because she's having this conversation from her lair because she shows up there in person very briefly. So you would think that she would be having it from some other source. But they have him go after them. He ties them up. He puts them at gunpoint and then he ties them up. And then they use their sharp and pointy friendship bracelets to break the rope. And... I love when they keep cutting away from him reciting his story about his whole backstory and how he came to be and how he came to be in the situation that he's in, where he's working for Sharon, and how all he ever wanted was to be an official couple. They keep cutting back and forth, and they are just barely roped together, with the rope in increasingly weirder positions, and they are slanted against one another. They even have the rope completely off at some point, and they just pretend to be tied up still. Until he leaves, which is very funny. But when they get up to go, they get punched out by Sharon Fisherman, and they wake up on a cliff. Again, there's no Florida rocky cliffs.
Yes, of course. And they wake up looking over the edge, and they sort of scream because, like, ah, look how high they are, but they're nowhere near the edge, really. Mm-hmm. But they're threatened with either jumping to their death and very graphically hitting all the rocks on the way down, or being eaten by alligators that are unleashed from two little containers, which don't attack Gordon, whatever. Sharon?
Yeah.
Shannon?
Sharon.
Sharon. Sharon Gordon. I can't even say that with a straight face. Maybe because, you know, she's a bad guy. They know they're bad guy. They're all on the same team.
Are you saying you can't trust Sharon Gordon Fisherman?
I can't. You know, she doesn't even wear a slicker at any point in the movie. But, you know, basically they're being pushed towards the edge by these very hungry alligators. And as the bad guys do, Sharon Gordon Fisherman leaves so she doesn't witness the death. But they jump off the cliff to kill themselves, but to save themselves from the alligators, and slowly parachute to the ground because of their culottes in a very undercover brother fashion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, It was one of those things where we forgot to mention we were talking about the absurdity at the beginning of the movie, with the paper route and the spy stuff. There is also a title card with the definition of culotte,
Yeah, the movie
or
opens with that.
yeah. So, and the Barb and Star talk about culottes several times, like their evening culottes and stuff. Like they mention them. They're excited to buy the culottes. They are wearing them in the scene. You did not necessarily expect them to parachute down to safety with them, but they do.
I certainly did not.
Yeah. But then they have to go get the transmitter and stop Edgar from his following through an evil plan. They arrive and get it, or sorry, they start to go get it. Sharon and Edgar have a confrontation where he finds out that, you know, they were not really spies, that he was duped into it, that, you know, Sharon didn't really want to follow through on any of this. And
There is no HPV agency.
yes. And when she goes to flip the switch and turn on the transmitter, he clocks her with his sand art in a jar.
Of course. It's one of those ones where you do it like with the toothpick or like not toothpick.
You
I used
just
to use the
pour.
big sticks or whatever, but
Yeah.
like you could just you set them in there very specifically, make your own art. Yeah. But she already pushed the button, or it looked more like he pushed the button because he didn't know what he was doing. So the mosquitoes are unleashed, which means that Mr. Yo-Yo, who has been slowly driving a submarine towards the coast for, I don't know, a third of the movie, pushes all of the dials in a very prolonged surfacing montage. Well, not montage. He just pushes all the buttons and turns all the knobs so he can elevate the submarine and fire all the mosquitoes into the air that follow the tracker.
I gotta say, when we were first introduced to the submarine, and it is piggybacking, or I don't know, it's underneath, so it's like piggy bellying, piggy undersiding, underneath the a larger, presumably U.S. naval sub or something.
I think it's called piggy bellying, yeah.
Yep. And he's steering back and forth, you know, side to side, even though it's just going in a straight line. And I'm like, oh, geez, like, what a stupid thing. And then she literally says to him on the phone call, don't forget tiny movements back and forth, constantly.
Yeah, don't hold the steering wheel too still.
Yeah.
Tiny movements back and forth.
Yeah. So I appreciated that.
Yeah.
And I hang a lantern on it.
Of course. The whole movie is a lantern. Meanwhile, Barb and Star are going to take the transmitter out to sea, but Edgar stops them and explains everything and blah blah blah. They all love each other, so they work together and. I forget he's gonna take it out there, but then he starts wrestling with I already forgot his name, Darley Bunkle. So they run away and they hop on a jet ski and say we need to commandeer your jet ski, sir. And he says, "Stop, say no more. I completely understand. Take the jet ski."
Which I also thought was very funny because usually there's that like protest and it's like, why even bother doing that? Just
Hey,
take
wait!
the
Give
jet.
me back my
Yeah.
jet ski. Yeah, as if this was a Bad Boys movie or something.
Yeah, so they go on the jet ski. This leaves Sharon no choice but to fire herself out of the cannon so that she has a chance of catching up to them.
Of course, because the seafood jam contest is presently occurring, and Sharon Gordon Fisherman looking extremely Willy Wonka with those glasses and the hood. Sorry, modern Willy Wonka, the Johnny Depp Willy Wonka. Is I guess re-triggered and traumatized, and her only method of transportation is to turn the cannon back up to probable death and fire herself out into the ocean to very accurately land on top of the jet ski. You know,
It's a good shot.
it's incredible.
And they have a little fight there about this, and then they hop off into the water. She gets mauled by mosquitoes.
Yeah, they take the key off the jet ski so she can't drive it back to shore, and then they dive underwater and hold their breath for a long time, and they communicate telepathically under the water.
Presumably, because their lips aren't moving.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're gesturing. A lot of people have sort of like an unspoken, you know, dialogue kind of thing if you've been friends for a long time, but they telepathically communicate how much, you know, the they care for each other and they're gonna die and I'm so sorry and all this stuff. And then there's a glowy thing that happens off camera, and then they're excited, and it appears they're gonna be rescued by some unknown figure.
Yeah, and Jamie Dornan is on shore with all the other people at Sifu Jam.
Who have their back to him, and he's literally just doing somersaults over top of Damon Wayans Jr., which is lovely.
Yeah, and he eventually gets to the point where he realizes that they've sacrificed their lives for everyone else, and they're so selfless, blah, 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 blah. But then he sees them come to shore, and they're carried on that glowing teal wave from Trish, which is Reba McEntire. As Trish, the water spirit from the story that they told to each other when they were leaving the plane earlier in the movie.
As an aside for weird characters, we totally neglected to mention, because it's irrelevant to the story, that there's also Morgan Freeman as a crab.
Oh, Morgan Freemund,
sure.
For legal reasons, is what they say. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it is just an impersonator of Morgan Freeman as a crab puppet who imparts some wisdom. Yeah.
Mostly after they've left, but yes.
Mm-hmm. But they arrive back on shore, and they're okay now, and they patch up their friendship, and Star kisses Edgar, and Annie Mumolo between them says that she's okay with him now too, and forgives him. And unbelievably, Kristen Wiig appears again as Sharon Gordon Fisherman, who somehow got back to shore too.
Yeah, covered in mosquito bites because she took the actual antidote.
Yeah, not the lemon flavored iced tea from the vending machine.
Although who knows, maybe it's lemon flavored iced tea. It was really the antidote, and she's a big fan of it in her beverages. So
I mean, there is that moment where he says, "You took the real antidote," and she says, "Of course." So I feel like that is a tacit acknowledgement that she actually had a real one, and that she did not give it to him. And the whole entire plan was for him to die. But you know, whatever. They have a confrontational moment with Barb asserting herself and how she's, you know, found herself, as a person and was willing to stand up for herself and for her friends, even in danger. And, that,
she's very assertive now.
Yeah. But she still can't, you know, can't find the right words for things. So now everybody needs to shut up and listen to Star, and Star has her greeting card wisdom to impart here about friendship, and the need to have having friends, and
together the sum of their parts is greater than the whole, you know.
Yeah, and this somehow melts Cher Gordon Fisherman's heart. It grew three sizes that day. She wants a friend now too, and unbelievably, you know, Star and Barb say that they'll be her friend now, and Jamie Dornan more realistically says, "This is weird, but okay." And
he anchors it while the movie attempts to sort of careen back into the absurdity that opened it.
Yeah, and so they're all going to be friends now, and we're going to close that out. Yay, happy ending. There's a minor credit scene where Yo-Yo shows up with an enormous gun, and it fires streamers out of it, and he says, "Let's boogie."
Good. They dance to Pitbull doing that song from Beetlejuice.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yes.
And then there's another two credit scenes. There's Talk Club, where Phyllis gets her tea taken away because she wants to talk about her horse, and then there's that one random guy in the crowd who says something about being friends. I'm not sure what that clip was there for.
Yeah, there was I don't know if you noticed, but at several points in the movie they pan across the sort of crowd of people who are at the hotel, and there's always one guy in a Speedo holding a cocktail. Mm-hmm. And he's just always there. It's never explained. He's always in a Speedo, always holding a cocktail. At the very end of the movie, he gets to say that,
God bless us, everyone.
Well, yeah, it's just whatever some ships or whatever ships, and the best ships are friendships, sure. Et cetera. His little poem. And then,
you pick your friends and you pick your nose.
And then the movie's actually closed out by the crab puppet. So that's it. That's the whole thing.
That's what happens. Barb and Star go to Vista Del Mar. We don't even know if they stayed in Vista Del Mar because they loved it so much, or if they went home to Nebraska, or if they took Edgar with them, or what. But presumably, doesn't Barb jokingly say, where are we all going to live, or something? So, of course, mm-hmm. they're all going to, you know, be roommates together, as you do.
Well, I mean, there's a huge lair now where they can all.
Oh, you think they're going to go back to the lair?
Well, I mean, it seems a waste of a lair to just, like, let it go.
I mean, it could really use some color, though.
Yeah, I mean, but it would be a great place for them to host their Thanksgivings.
Mm. I mean, it's already got a soda fountain. That's a pretty big attraction for a gathering. I don't even drink soda. I would go to a Thanksgiving that I was invited to if it had a soda fountain.
So like at a Ponderosa or like a Sizzler or something?
No, like if a person was like, hey, come to our house for Thanksgiving, we have a soda fountain. I'd be like, well, this is weird. I want to see what else they have in store.
No.
Even if it was just the soda fountain when I got there, I would be intrigued.
Dan, I cannot think of a bigger red flag than a human being, an adult human being, who owns a soda fountain in their house.
I can think of one. An adult human being who buys entirely too much Crown Royal.
Oh. Yeah, that would do it too. Presumably, there is some overlap. There's a Venn diagram where those two intersect.
Yeah.
I don't know if you watched...
I think I know this person, actually.
Oh, well, I don't know if you watched the TV show Hacks, but...
I have not.
Jean Smart, her character, who's kind of like a Joan Rivers kind of older comedian, she has her own soda fountain in her house. She's not a particularly nice person in the course of events that go on in the series, but she's, you know, fun.
So you're saying only villains have soda fountains in their homes? So.
Well, she's not a villain. She's, you know, just a little prickly, which I, you know, can admire.
You can admire prickliness?
I can admire prickliness.
You aspire to prickliness?
I don't aspire to prickliness. I am prickly, so I can admire it in others.
So you're saying at some point in your life you're going to have a soda fountain in your home?
No.
It's faded. If for no other reason, because it would be a signifier to sort of
my
put
prickliness?
You socially on the same level as Jean Smart and Sharon Gordon Fisherman.
Yes. I'll call
it
says,
don't mess with me.
The Sharon Gordon Fisherman Memorial Soda Fountain.
Now, okay, you have a soda fountain in your home in tribute to Sharon Gordon Fisherman. What five or six beverages come out of your soda fountain?
Well, are we talking about strictly, are we talking about the stuff you would find in a regular soda fountain? Or are we talking about like it's made up whatever stuff?
I want both. Stuff that would be found in a soda fountain initially. No, you know, they stretched a little bit and put the iced tea in there. That's usually in a separate machine or something. But let's do regular machine and then like Barb and Star Universe Joe Steel machine. You get five. Let's do five beverages.
Oh boy. Okay. So for the real ones, because that'll be easier to do.
Do we need the ground rule that it needs to be for the suicide beverage, or is this just you can have them one off by themselves?
Oh, they can be one off by themselves.
Okay, but, all right.
I mean, if they happen to work together, then that's, you know, a coincidence.
Okay, fair enough. But, go ahead.
Okay, so what I would do is have Sprite, because you need to have the one that has the little button underneath for water, and that's always the Sprite.
Yes.
I would have...
You're a Sprite, not like a Sierra Mist. I don't know the difference between the two, but I believe there is one.
Sierra Mist is a PepsiCo product. And
do they
Sprite
still make 7-Up? Is that still a thing?
Yes, but it's not a Pepsi company. That's why they tried to push Sierra Mist.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just asking in general, 7-Up is still a
yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
You put that on your thing.
It's still a thing, as far as I know.
Okay.
Right. I haven't really looked in a lot of soda fountains recently. But an absolute must is Dr. Pepper and Diet Dr. Pepper. And
I'm sorry. Are you saying Diet Dr. Pepper specifically, or you would have both Dr. Pepper and Diet Dr. Pepper in your soda fountain?
I would have both because they're two different sodas, Dan.
You have five little dispensers on your soda fountain, and you're going to take up two of them with Dr. Pepper.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
I don't really like a lot of other sodas, so it's actually a really easy choice for me to do it.
Jeez.
And then I would have either Canada Dry or Schweppes ginger ale, depending on who I can get the best deal with.
What is happening here?
I would have A&W root beer or mug root beer, either of the two.
Yeah, I think mug is sort of the one that really works hard to get into soda fountains, but... Yeah. Wow. Okay. So to recap for the listeners, Sprite, Dr. Pepper, Diet Dr. Pepper. What did you say? You said ginger ale.
Yes.
And then
root beer.
Root beer. Wow.
And remember, the Sprite is just so you can have the button for water.
Yeah, okay, sure. Individually, I can understand a lot of these. The idea of mixing these together is horrifying to me in any way.
Well, I mean, there's nothing wrong with mixing Dr. Pepper and root beer together. And you have two Dr. Peppers and a root beer, so they would mix fine. Or you could mix together the ginger ale and the Sprite. But I wouldn't mix any of those other ones together, other than those combinations.
I feel like both Dr. Pepper and root beer are usually the sweeter counterpoint to like a more base level cola. So putting the two of them together, that's a lot of sweetness you're putting together there and weirdness.
Well,
don't get me wrong, I'm a fan of root beer and Dr. Pepper sort of separately, but putting those two together, like just by themselves, seems really strange.
Not really.
Okay. All right. Let's.
It's got a little bit more zip than Coke, because I wouldn't put
a little bit more high fructose corn syrup.
Well, I wouldn't put regular Coke in there, and I no longer really enjoy either the taste or experience of having a Diet Coke. And if anybody came over to my house and said they wanted a Diet Coke, I want to be able to point to the soda fountain and say, "Do you see Diet Coke there?" No. Then we get into the.
You're forgetting the greatest Coke of all time, which is Cherry Coke.
I know. Yeah. And I like Cherry Coke. I really do. But you're talking about sweet. That's super sweet, Dan.
Yeah, of course. But that's why you don't mix it with, like, root beer or Dr. Pepper.
Yeah. Remember in the mid-90s when they had that, what was it, Wild Cherry Pepsi that they tried to make happen? It was never as good as Cherry Coke.
Cherry Pepsi? I think you can still buy Cherry Pepsi.
Yeah. But remember when they called it Wild Cherry Pepsi? Like, as if it was
wild. It was a different flavor of some sort. Yeah, I think their branding is still probably better than Cherry Coke, because Cherry Coke still has that extremely AOL sort of aesthetic to it, where it's like the red square with like dots on it and like that jaggedy font.
Yeah, well, remember when they added cherry vanilla and they had just like the same thing, but it had those little diagonal lines through it?
Yeah, the vanilla Coke, I think, I don't know if that's still a thing, but then everyone's like, you can get the cherry and the vanilla and you can mix them together and get a cherry vanilla. I was like, this is an abomination. I'm sorry, this is a step too far.
Yeah, well, they have those, I forget the name of the machine, but the Coca-Cola machines that have the touch screens.
Oh, yeah, where you could be like, I want 3 dashes of vanilla, 1 dash of orange, and 1 dash of cherry in my Coke.
Yeah, I mean, I don't need that level of control. There's a button. Push the button.
You know what that is? That machine? Mm-hmm. That machine is peak capitalism.
We've gone too far. Late stage capitalism is being able to
pick
your flavoring.
That was the high watermark for just the society's downfall. Mm-hmm. It was all downhill after those machines showed up.
Yeah, but what are your 5 that you would pick for your soda fountain?
Do you want me to do my regular 5 and then you can come back to your idealized Joe Steele world 5?
Yeah.
Or do you want to do yours first?
No, I want you to do your regular 5 first.
All right, so there's definitely a Cherry Coke. There's definitely a root beer. I think I agree with you that I would go with an A&W, but I feel like Mug is more common. Let's see. I like a Dr. Pepper. I feel like that deserves a permanent spot there. There will be no diet sodas of any sort on my machine. I think I'm going to put a Mountain Dew.
Whoa.
And then I think...
Which Mountain Dew?
Standard Mountain Dew.
Because,
you know, a standard Mountain Dew, you can either do a little bit by yourself, but that will tolerate a little bit of mixing with something else. Like a little bit of that Mountain Dew in maybe the Cherry Coke. I don't really know where you would go with that. You don't want to put Mountain Dew in a root beer. That would be weird.
No, but you know what you could combine, though, is if you could get Mountain Dew Code Red in your soda fountain, then you could mix it with your Cherry Coke and you could mix it with your root beer.
I don't know. The Mountain Dew Code Red would get way less use than regular Mountain Dew, because regular Mountain Dew is kind of like, it's almost like a slightly off Sprite. But like Mountain Dew Code Red is like, it's like a real bad hangover. Like you can only do it like once every 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm going with regular Mountain Dew, but I would throw a wild card into that number 5 slot. I think that's got to be one of those like raspberry Lipton teas that you always find like attached to a machine.
Oh my God.
It's straight sugar, but that is like her, what's the one that she, the tea that she just puts a dash in for the little bit of something there?
Yeah, the lemon flavored tea.
Yeah, when you want to go a little bit, when you want to really turn the knob up to 11, you put a little dash of that Lipton raspberry tea in there.
I don't know how you made fun of my selection and that you put Lipton raspberry tea in
Yeah.
yours.
Yeah.
That is canonically the worst.
Untrue. Untrue. I think I am incredibly basic compared to your selections, but I don't think I'm wrong.
My mom used to buy the 2 liters that you could get of the Lipton raspberry.
Oh, we all did.
Oh, it was so bad. I thought I
Yeah.
hated iced tea my whole life until I had unsweetened iced tea, and I was like, "What is this?
Yeah.
It tastes like tea. It tastes
Remember the early
refreshing."
2000s where you would get those bottles of, I think it was still Lipton brand. You would get like the green tea, which just left the most horrible residue in your mouth. There was the raspberry tea, which was more sugar than you should probably consume in a month in a single bottle of it. But they were like the same bottle. One was just green and one was clear.
Yeah, well, remember Arizona?
Oh, it's still around. I look at it. I look at it in the little cooler at Walgreens or whatever, and I think I could drink 6 ounces of that and be real good. But it's like a 48 ounce can. And then I just look at the can and I can taste it, and I was like, you know what? I don't need it.
No, it's so sugary. It has such a weirdly artificial flavor, despite the fact that it should just be sugar and tea and water.
Yeah.
It is so bizarre. I don't enjoy it at all.
Well, the raspberry and the peach teas,
Like Snapple,
suburban
peach Snapple.
suburban Ahwatukee, but no, those two, the Arizona raspberry and peach tea, we would buy them from the drink cart lady that drove around the golf courses when we were kids. Not on the golf course, obviously, we were just near a golf course. But that's what those mean to me. But it wasn't until I met my lovely life partner, lady friend here, that she introduced me to the Arizona iced tea sweet tea, which somehow manages to be twice as sweet as any of the other Arizona iced teas in terms of sugar content, but is also it's delicious for 1.5 sips and then you want to die.
No, thank you. I don't like sweet tea,
Yeah.
and I can't imagine I would ever want to have the Arizona version of it.
No, but you started to say Snapple. Do you still have any love in your heart for Snapple?
No, I never liked Snapple. I liked the.
Snapples are good though.
No, they're not. They're really
Yeah,
not.
I like a Snapple, a peach Snapple.
Okay.
Again, I don't drink them.
No.
I
Well,
can
anyway.
go into my memory bank and taste them anytime I like. That flavor never leaves your synapses.
Just
Like
go
you
into
can just remember what it tastes like.
the soda fountain in your memory palace, and you can
The
taste it whenever
soda
you want
fountain.
to.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Okay. So do your idealized any 5 beverages in a soda fountain for you, hot or cold?
Well, hot, that's interesting. But you know
Well,
me, that
this is fake world.
yeah, you know me, there would always be cold. So first off, we're just gonna put in stump down cold brew in one of them, because that way you can just have cold brew whenever you wanted. It'd be great. I see no
Yeah.
downsides and no way it could be over caffeinated at all.
If you had cold brew at a soda fountain, no,
Yeah.
not at all. You could drink
No.
a 64 ounce of cold brew every 2 hours.
Yeah, you'd be super wired, but you'd be fine. Just
You could be never not drinking cold brew.
I mean, I have a feeling that if you actually owned a soda fountain, some of the allure would be some of the luster of it would be taken off by the fact that you'd be like replacing the like big heavy metal canister things that go underneath and having to order the big
Yeah.
heavy metal canisters and deal with the delivery and return of the things and all that.
And cleaning out the lines and balancing the syrups and the carbonation. Yeah, it's just like owning a pool. Like you don't like pools anymore because it's all you do is spend your time and money cleaning the pool.
You hate pools.
I do.
But
It's very dusty.
so anyway, cold brew. And then I would have Topo Chico, specifically Topo Chico, not
Specifically Topo Chico.
specifically Topo Chico, because I like it is a very aggressive sparkle to their sparkling water, and I
Is
would
it more
enjoy to
aggressive
have
than
that.
a Perrier?
I feel like it is. However, Topo Chico goes flat very quickly. If you have a large bottle of it and you open it, you better enjoy that real fast.
Right. Well, they're glass bottles with no, they're not resealable, where you get like a Perrier with a twist cap. You can cap that boy back up.
Yeah, but they don't, it still doesn't keep as much of the gas in solution. So it would be good to have in a fountain where it would always have the carbonation that you want whenever you want it. So that's why that's my rationale for it being inside of a fountain.
Okay. All right. Three more.
Mm-hmm. And then I would have. Let me think.
Now we're realizing how boring we are as human beings because we don't drink more than two things, coffee and water.
I know. I'm just trying to think. And I think it's just coffee and water. And then the rest of them, I would just be like different kinds of bourbon. that doesn't seem...
like champagne. Champagne's fizzy. You could throw some of that in there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, since it is, you know, weird, we might as well. Except I wouldn't want to have champagne that came from a soda fountain. Because...
But that is incredibly MTV Cribs of you to have champagne from a soda fountain. Like that's a show off to your friends kind of thing.
Yeah, but it's not going to be good. It's not like you're going to get Cristal to send you the thing. Like
it's not supposed to be good. It's supposed to be champagne that comes out of a soda fountain.
I know. I just don't want to have like Andre on demand or something or Corbel whenever I feel like it. That doesn't seem like a benefit to me.
Well, if you put that in one of them and put orange juice in the next one, you can just have mimosas on tap.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, I guess. Let's do bourbon, and then we'll do Gruet, which is a méthode champenois from New Mexico. And it's a reasonably priced thing that I wouldn't feel too bad about putting inside of a metal canister. And then some orange juice. And we'd be set. Oh, wait, No. No. Way better answer than orange juice.
Okay, go ahead. Back up.
Aperol. So that way, you can have an Aperol spritz because you could put together the Topo Chico, the Gruet, and the Aperol, and you got a spritz going. Gruet is not Prosecco, of course, but it would be fine.
Of course. Mm-hmm. okay, interesting. All right. So is that five or is that four?
Mm-hmm. That's five because I've got cold brew, Topo Chico, bourbon, and then I have the
champagne and Aperol.
Aperol and champagne. Well, it's not technically champagne. It was sparkling wine.
Sure. Of course. Thank you for being incredibly specific.
Yeah, the champagne region of fountain drinks. All right. So you drew a made up one.
I think I'm very close to you on most of the idealized ones. I mean, there's no reason not to put cold brew because obviously I still prefer hot coffee, but like you can have cold brew. I want whatever can be the fizziest of fizzy waters. I think Perrier is fizzier, but if you think Topo Chico is, I'm okay with your Topo Chico fountain, but I would lean Perrier. I feel like I would go Las Vegas and do one of those like pre-mixed margarita things that just like spins around for hours at a time. So I could just like pull a knob and get a margarita.
No. Well, see, if we're doing something
really
where
soda
you
fountain so much as like a slushy machine.
Yeah. If we're doing slushy machines, then I have a different answer. That's not a soda fountain, though.
Don't change the rules on me now. You didn't say no slushy machines at the beginning.
Yeah. Like if we're doing slushy machines, then I'm going to have frosé. Specifically,
oh, of course you are.
Specifically, the frosé that they make at the Rose Cafe in Venice, California, called the Faded. Jason cannot taste the tequila in it whenever we have ordered it, and it tastes so strongly of tequila that I find it almost comical. We definitely get that one.
Hmm. Mm. You know, there's a place in Mesa that is a cider brewery, and they make a slushy what's the alcoholic wine drink, a slushy sangria cider thing that's actually very good that would also be well suited to a slushy machine. Yeah, I don't know. I don't really have other ones. You know, I would do champagne on tap just to be Puff Daddy on MTV Cribs. And then I've got two more that I don't really know what to do with, to be honest, because all I drink is fizzy water and coffee.
Well, you could just fill it up with different kinds of fizzy water and coffee.
You know what? One of them would be Martinelli's apple juice because that's a craving from time to time.
Wait, the flat apple juice or the sparkling?
You know what? One of each. And then I'm done.
I cannot believe you made fun of me for getting Dr. Pepper and Diet Dr. Pepper. You're going to do flat Martinellis and sparkling Martinellis.
You know, that's one person's version of classiness somewhere out there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, somewhere
we've got both Martinellis.
Yeah. So this is our phone conversation about a plain conversation about Trish is apparently the fountain drinks. So there we go. We've successfully done that. Now the fountain drinks will save us from certain death at the end of the film.
Yeah. This movie's weird. I don't know how anyone could ever watch it more than once. Just like drinking any sort of combination of these soda fountain drinks, it's once and you're done. I guess I'm glad that it's on Hulu now and I didn't have to rent it or whatever, and I watched it. So Barb and Star went to Vista Del Mar, and then maybe someday we will too.
You're such a stick in the mud. This is
well, it's because I haven't been to Vista Del Mar. I haven't expanded my horizons.
It's not a real place. But you know, I like this movie. I'm sorry you didn't like it very much.
I didn't dislike it. It's got lots of parts that I enjoyed, especially Mr. 50 Shades of What's a Who's It. It was extremely weird, and most extremely weird movies like this. Of the Will Ferrell set, which this is a subset of that, usually miss my interest a bit.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I'm glad they went. I'm glad they rediscovered themselves.
Yeah, it worked out well for them.
Yeah, good. It's a good look on them.
Mm-hmm.
We love that for them. Isn't that what they say?
Burning like my blood's in a pan on a stove, and it's heating me up to the max. So I'm running my legs just as fast as I can, to the left, to the right. I'm a frustrated man. Now I'm flicking my tiptoes to kick up the sand, 'cause I can't understand all this fire that's raging inside me. Seagulls in the sand, can you hear my prayer? I keep trying, but I'm getting nowhere. It's in a fog, I'm under a spell. Am I in heaven or am I in hell? Leaping, doing the splits from my heart, going higher and higher, my legs spread apart. Now I'm twirling like a baby ballerina who's digging a hole with the force of his feet. Watch me climbing. I'm going up a palm tree like a cat up a palm tree who's decided to go up a palm tree. Seagull on the tire, can you hear?